Okay. Well, good afternoon. I'd like to call this hearing of the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. I want to remind members to please mute your feeds and use the raising hand feature if you would like to ask a question, and then just leave it up there until the staff takes it down. So Ms. Niedernhofer's let me know that a quorum is present, but I would just have her go through the roll, listing who's on the roll, and then if you don't hear your name, let us know at the end. So Ms. Niedernhofer?
Hi. I have Liebling, Schumacher, Akam, Baker, Bierman, Branson, Grunhagen, Haley, Halverson, Jordan, Keel, Kunish Pudin, Moran, Munson, Noor, and Schultz.
All right. Anybody who was missed? Okay, not seeing any hands. So if anybody was missed, why let us know at the end also, and we'll make sure you get recorded. So members, thank you very much for getting on this afternoon. This is likely our last hearing of the session. So it's been a bit of a scramble to try to figure out what we could get done and get things moved off to Ways and Means today. So I appreciate your indulgence. We've had some fiscal notes that we were waiting on that have come in kind of recently, and some things that we had to post kind of late just because, as you know, we're in very unusual times and trying to deal with a lot of big issues that are also pretty fast moving. So thank you for your indulgence. As you know, we may have to adjourn at our regular time, 2:15, and come back at 6 o'clock. I hope we don't have to do that. We're going to try to move as expeditiously as we can with respect to members' time. So, first of all, we have the minutes of April 30th. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Okay. The minutes of April 30th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing no discussion, please unmute yourselves if you would. And all those in favor of approval of the minutes of April 30th, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So the first bill that we're going to take up today is House File 4374. And this is Representative Pinto.
And Madam Chair, are you having the bill moved before bill presentation?
Yeah, sure. So, so Representative Pinto, do you want to go ahead and move your bill? And it's going to Ways and Means.
And Madam Chair, I was I wish I was on your committee, and I was last term, but I am not. I'm not this chair.
Sorry about that. Okay, well then the chair will move that House File 4374 be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. Sorry about that, Representative Pinto. I talk to you so often about these things, I just forget that you're not actually on the committee. So please go ahead and present your bill. And I know you have one testifier. I don't know if he's, or there is a testifier. I'm not sure if he's your testifier, but anyway, please go ahead and present.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, and the Early Childhood Division, of course, reports up to your committee. So so especially, so I'm disappointed not to have had the chance to serve with you all this term, but I definitely feel like I'm part of the committee in some form anyway. So House File 4374 addresses a concern about the rate setting for our child care assistance program. The federal government requires that of course provides significant funding for that program and requires that rates be set at the 25th percentile of a survey that's taken every 3 years of providers. Minnesota is out of compliance with that requirement. I should note, you probably realize that's a pretty low requirement. You go down 75 percentage points in that survey. And so our rates for our providers are fairly low to begin with, but our rates don't even meet that standard. They are the 25th percentile of the 2011 rates. And so what this bill would do is to simply bring our rates up to be in federal compliance and to increase the rates to be the 25th percentile of the most recent survey, which currently is 2018. And again, it's done every couple of years. There is not a cost in the next couple of years because there is more than $60 million in federal funding that is awaiting this change that can be used to pay for it. If we don't make this change, there'll be a more than $5 million penalty. But of course, there'll also be the penalty on providers not getting paid decently and on having our kids not cared for the way that they should be. So there's all kinds of reasons to do this. And yes, the testifier is mine, Madam Chair, and I'd love to have him speak if he can now.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So Daniel Gumnett, if you could just introduce yourself for the record, and please, and if you could be brief, please, we would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And yes, I promise I will be very brief. And I'm Daniel Gumnett, CEO of People Serving People. And I'm here today on behalf of People Serving People, the Minnesota Prenatal to Three Coalition and Kids Can't Wait. And we strongly support House File 4374. People Serving People is the region's largest and most comprehensive shelter for children and their families experiencing homelessness. We're located in downtown Minneapolis, and People Serving People is at the epicenter of childhood and family homelessness in Minnesota. We shelter nearly 2,000 children and their families each year. Families are strong, our families are strong, and the children are amazing, and parents experiencing homelessness are striving, like all of us, to do the best they can for their kids. And even though People Serving People is an emergency shelter, our largest investments are actually in early childhood education and parental engagement. We operate 2 4-star parent aware rated programs at our locations, and often these programs are the first structured learning environments that children experiencing homelessness participate in. Now, our families rely heavily on childcare assistance to access programs, both our own and many others. However, finding space can be extremely difficult because the current provider rates, as Representative Pinto mentioned, are so low. Providers can't often afford to accept children relying on childcare assistance. This means that providers lose money if they choose to serve families using child care assistance, and it makes making it very difficult for them to serve these low-income families, grow their business, provide quality care, and pay their staff wages. So an investment in child care assistance is an investment not only in the children and families, but in early educators whose wages are being suppressed by these low reimbursement rates. Minnesota has not paid the federally recommended rates since 2003, and it's no wonder we've had a child care crisis before COVID-19 and have an even greater one now. So in conclusion, we passionately believe that if we're going to break the cycle of poverty and homelessness, we need to expand access to financial resources such as child care assistance. This is vital to reducing childhood homelessness, closing the education opportunity gap, developing our state's future workforce. Minnesota has been out of compliance with federal child care law for far too long. We must at least use the federal funds to come to a minimal compliance this year. A structural investment will help families and child care providers during this COVID emergency and as our community recovers from the pandemic. Thank you very much, Chair and members. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? I haven't seen any pop up here. All right, not seeing any. Representative Pinto, do you want to make a closing remark before we vote on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just very briefly, I'll just note to members that there is a cost in the tails of more than $17 million. We do expect that that would actually be covered by federal funds that are CCDBG federal funding has never gone down. And if it stays at the same level, it will easily cover that. It's just MMB's rules couldn't account for that. I will note that there is a $53,000 cost per year, simply for some IT connected to this. So the spending, and we're obviously, I know we need to be making a lot of budget decisions, but the spending of $53,000 will leverage more than $60 million federal dollars and help our providers and families. So it's time to do this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Pinto. So with that, the chair will renew the motion that House File 4374 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. So we will take the roll on the bill. Ms. Niedernhofer, the chair votes aye.
Schumacher.
Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
No.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Franson. Franson. Grunhagen.
No.
Haley.
No.
Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
No.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
No.
Kunish Pudin.
Yes.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson.
No.
Noor.
Aye.
Olson excused. Schultz.
Aye.
And then I'll go back to Franson.
Yes.
Yes, you vote yes?
Yes.
Yeas and 7 nays.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. There being 12 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Pinto, and to the testifier. Okay, the next bill that we will take up is going to be the House File 4579. And that is my bill. So I'm going to move that House File 4579 to Ways and Means. But we have a DE2 amendment, which has been posted. So I'm going to move the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which I would like to discuss it. So if we could first vote on that, I think we could just do a voice vote. If you would unmute your lines. So all in favor of the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, so members, thank you for your indulgence on this. This is really a work in progress. This is probably what we would want to refer to as phase two of the COVID relief. Well, phase two, you know, phase one, the administration engaged in a contract with Mayo Clinic and the U of M to really greatly expand our testing for the coronavirus. And that is moving forward at a rapid pace. And this is really the next thing that we need to do as a state to make that testing worthwhile. As most people understand, it doesn't do you a lot of good to just test if you don't follow up. And probably this activity that we're doing is about the most important thing that we can really do to get where we all want to go, which is reopening our economy and getting us back on track just as quickly as possible. It becomes nearly impossible to do that if we don't have a good handle on where the virus is, who has it, and then be able to control the virus by figuring out who's been exposed and then isolating those people. And when we don't have a good handle on that, we end up isolating pretty much everybody, which is what has been happening. And we see where that leads us. So I think we all understand that's not a long-term strategy. We need to have a better, more focused strategy of dealing with the virus. So this is the next attempt. We're trying to work with the Senate on this. And I think there was some frustration in the last round of funding for this effort that the administration needed to move forward very quickly, and there wasn't a lot of opportunity for legislative input. But here the legislature is, we are attempting to do this together, and so this DE that is before you was drafted with some input from MDH, but it's really kind of my work in progress. Would love to have your input on it. We're going to have MDH testify a little bit. And also, we need to fill in the numbers here. And just so you understand, the numbers are also really a work in progress. And it is my desire to just fill this in. Since this is likely our last hearing, we're not going to have a lot of opportunity to fine-tune this. But the idea is to move this to Ways and Means and have a broader discussion between the administration, the legislature, both the House and Senate, and come up with the best number that we can. And hopefully a lot of this, frankly, will be paid for with federal funding. That's what this CARES Act funding, one of the big reasons that we have that funding and what it was intended for is to help us with exactly this kind of activity. So with that introduction, I'm going to first turn this over to, I don't know if Margaret Kelly is here. I think she may be wanting to address us from the Department of Health. I know that Dan Huff is also here, but Ms. Kelly, do you want to start off and talk a little bit about what this is about? And then I know we do have a couple members on the list already. Maybe before you start, I should just find out if those members want to have questions or if they want to wait for the presentation and then ask their questions. Representative Haley, did you want to go now or hold on?
I can wait, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Representative Munson?
I can wait, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. So let's start with Ms. Kelly then. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just want to acknowledge that this is my first Zoom hearing, and also acknowledge that this is a home haircut as well, so it's my COVID cut. I just want to thank you, Representative Liebling, and the others who have worked on this bill. It is an important bill, and as you mentioned, phase two, I want to give a little context to that. Commissioner Malcolm negotiated an agreement with the U of M and Mayo for what we considered phase one of coronavirus testing so that we could significantly ramp up our testing statewide. While we were the lowest in the state for COVID cases, we were not the highest for the number of tests we were doing. So our case count a couple weeks ago was number 52. Our testing, we were about number 32. And so our concern was that we simply were not detecting the number of cases that actually existed in the state. So the contract with Mayo and the U ensures us significant capacity to process tests on the back end. And we had envisioned a phase two, which included this contact, case investigation and contact tracing. It also included some work on focused testing around specific populations that may not be readily accessible to the healthcare system. So vulnerable populations in shelters, or people who are uninsured, or people who do not have the same access to healthcare that the rest of the population has. And it also, phase two envisioned some surveillance work to understand the viability of serological testing and to do more research into specific populations as well. And one of the goals in the phase two was also to ramp up our case investigation and contact tracing, which is what this bill does address. And let me tell you a little bit first about the case investigation and contact tracing process. So you go to the doctor and you get a COVID test, or it happens in a hospital. That test is then sent to a lab for processing. At the Department of Health, any test that comes in, we are able to turn around within 24 hours, sometimes less. Other labs, depending on the volume, they may have a 24 to 48 hour turnaround time. Many systems in the state use a national reference lab that could have a 7-day turnaround time. And so once your test is returned from the lab, the outcome then is provided to your health care provider, who reaches back to you to let you know if it was positive or negative. At that point in time, the Department of Health, for all tests that are positive, we begin our case investigation outreach, assuming that we have the needed information from the provider on how to contact that individual. And so it could be anywhere from 24 hours from when you took your test to when you get a call from the health department to up to 7 or 8 or 9 days. And that can depend on how quickly the test got to the lab, how quickly the lab processed the test, how quickly your healthcare provider reached out to you and reached out to MDH. And when we had a low case count, we were able to do our case investigation within 24 hours. And assuming that the test had been turned around in 24 hours, we were able to have people isolate relatively quickly in their incubation period. With more cases happening and with a higher volume of testing and with the diversity of individuals who are testing positive, it is taking us longer to do that initial outreach to individuals, especially with some of the recent cases in Nobles County and now in Stearns County. We are having to engage interpreters to help us with that. We are working hand in hand with local public health. Many of the positive cases do not have contact information. It has made it difficult for us to follow up with people. So we are imagining in our phase two, as we ramp up testing, that we are going to need to pivot our approach in case investigation and contact tracing so that we are intervening sooner. And one of the reasons for that is that as we have more people tested and more positive cases, we want to ensure we are acting as quickly as possible to have them isolate themselves to contain the virus. But also we want to ensure that we are doing that with their contacts as well. And rather than waiting for a longer period of time to have that happen, we want to be able to do it as quickly as possible. And so we may work with healthcare providers to provide individuals who get tested with a way to work with the health department right away, so that we are reaching out to them to say, you have been tested. If you're symptomatic, you should start isolating now. As soon as you hear from your provider, give us a call. Let's find out who you've been in contact with and talk with them about isolating as well. And so with this sort of a strategy, we are going to need to dramatically build up our capacity to do the case investigation and contact work. When the outbreak began, we had about 20 people on MDH staff who were doing this work. We now have over 200, and we are imagining that if we were to do aggressive and early case investigation and contact tracing, we could need as many as 4,200 tracers. And that is the equivalent of standing up a department 2.5 times the size of the Department of Health right now. It's a huge endeavor. We are going to have to change the way in which we record all of our contacts and we record case information. Right now, we're using a system that many states use called MEDS, but that system would not have the capacity to do this level of work for us. And we need to write scripts. We need to have a step-by-step way in which people who are brand new to case investigation and contact tracing can quickly learn what they have to do to be effective. So we're imagining we are going to need a couple of things in order to be successful at this endeavor. One is that we need a short-term plan. How are we going to ramp up our ability to do this work? And we are partnering with local public health. We have trained them and brought them on board and surveyed their capacity to assist us with this. We are redeploying staff within the Department of Health and within other agencies. We are partnering with the U of M to bring on students from the School of Public Health. We are partnering with other entities outside of the state workforce to bring on volunteers to help us with. And all of these efforts can get us to a capacity of maybe 300 to 500 tracers for a limited period of time. At some point, the department will try to return to normal. At some point, other agencies will need their staff back who we are borrowing. And so this is a short-term solution to bridge us to when we have our more longer-term solution for case investigation and contact tracing. At that point, we are also going to be needing an IT system build out, and we are already interviewing vendors who have provided IT solutions for other states to see which would work best for the state of Minnesota. We probably are going to need to contract with an entity to provide us the personnel solution. Hiring all those people is more than I can imagine having to do in a short period of time with a state agency HR complement. And we would prefer to simply contract with a vendor to provide us the staffing that we need, provide them the criteria of what the skills, qualifications, demographic makeup needs to be of that workforce so that we are able to meet the needs of the cases we need to investigate. We also are going to need to beef up the capacity at local public health to support us in this work as they redeploy their own staff. There are several other things that local public health does effectively at the local level. When we have an outbreak, they are providing the supportive wraparound services for anyone who needs to isolate in their home and can't go to the grocery store or needs medicine delivered to them. They are also assisting us hand in hand with support work for long-term care facilities and other entities that are experiencing outbreaks within their community. And so we need to provide greater financial assistance to local public health to do this. And we also need to provide similar assistance to our tribal government so that they can both test and do the case investigation and contact tracing within their communities as well. So I'm gonna stop there and let you ask questions, or I can give you a number and let that sort of sit there with you for a while. It's up to you, Madam Chair.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Kelly. And I'm just not sure if in the beginning, if you gave your title and everybody understands who
I'm
you
sorry.
Are.
Thank you. Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And on the line with me is Dan Huff, who's Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health as well.
All right, well, thank you so much. So we're gonna take some questions, but before we do that, I just wanting to let everybody know. So this amendment that is before us has some blanks in it. And I don't know if any of the questions were going to pertain to the blanks. We're not passing out a bill with blanks in it. Although I have to say that the numbers that I would like to propose to amend into the bill are again, a work in progress. So I've discussed this with Ms. Kelly. This could very well be lowballing it, frankly, but let's take the questions just so everyone understands that. If anyone was going to say, how are we going to pass a bill with blanks in it? I just wanted to answer that preemptively. So with that out there, let's go to Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner Kelly, and for everything your department is doing during this management of the pandemic. Madam Chair, this might be for you. I just want to understand better the language around an employee that the language says an employer can't retaliate against an employee who might leave their job to take one of these jobs. And my concern is, we don't want to be in a position where we are losing our critical healthcare workers to take one of these jobs and they don't return to direct care, which is so needed. So maybe I'm not understanding the language right, or maybe that's something, as you said, this is a little bit of a work in progress, but I just wanted to point out that concern, and maybe you have a response to that.
Yeah, thank you for raising that, Representative Haley. So this comes out of a concern that I had heard that that there were some medical employers who were restricting their furloughed employees from taking temporary jobs in other sectors where they might be really needed to deal with COVID-19, because they wanted them available to come back. And this is a work in process. Frankly, I haven't talked to Senator Benson about this. I don't know. This hasn't been fully worked through as I'd like to do it, and as it surely will by the end with the hospitals and so on. The intention here, you heard Ms. Kelly talking about, we're going to need a lot of people. And this is intended to be temporary. This is not building a whole new agency or, hiring, God help us if it's really 4,200 new employees. We're not intending to, grow state government by 4,200 permanent employees. Far from it. So this, the idea is a very quick build out. And then people go back to their other jobs as the need for their service diminishes in this area. So the thought was there are a lot of furloughed healthcare people right now, nurses, even physicians, other kinds of healthcare folks, and they might have a really great skill set for this kind of work and could be trained to be contact tracers and do this sort of really, because this is work that not just anybody can do. They have to be very sensitive. They have to answer questions. This is the face of the health department for people. And so it was the thought that this might be a really good workforce for that, but they have other jobs. But the problem is if their current employer won't let them go, even on a temporary basis, to do this other job, that could be a real problem. And that's what this is trying to get at. Okay. And I'm certainly, as I say, this is a work in progress. I'm not utterly wedded to this, but I wanted to put this out there just so that this isn't a barrier for us as we try to repurpose. I mean, it's good for the state if Minnesotans get back to work. Let's face it, instead of being on unemployment, and these are skilled people. So that's what I was trying to get at here. Representative Haley?
Yeah, follow up. Thank you for that explanation. And I agree with you. The more that we can get our furloughed folks that are trained in these fields working, the better. But I guess just if we pay attention to that language to make sure that when they are called back to work in the direct care environment, that they're ready to return where we need them. And I think to your point of accessing a large number of folks for a short-term assignment. Let's make sure we can look to other state departments who may be able to pitch in and where folks aren't currently needed. Maybe it's not going 100% out to the private sector. We know we're facing a significant budget shortfall going into summer and into next year. And there may be opportunities in other departments that we can reassign folks. So just wanted to point that out as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Haley. That's a really good thought. And this language is all written in a very permissive way because we just don't know what's going to be needed. And I think that's an excellent suggestion to the department if there are those people available. And of course, as I said, not everybody's going to be suitable for this work. But there will be many people who can be trained up and do this work very well. And we definitely want to use the people who are out of work if we can. Minnesotans, by the way, to the greatest degree possible. So let's see, next on the list, Representative Munza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just catching up, I didn't catch there was a DE, so it's very different from the original bill. My question is around the data privacy of the data that's collected. On the testing results, and where is that going to be housed, and will it be in the same location of where current data is reported to the Department of Health, and will this information that's used in contract tracing also be published to the emergency responders as the executive order that Walls put forward does, and what kind of protections do we have on this data?
Ms. Kelly, is that for you or for Mr. Huff?
I can start, and Mr. Huff can bail me out if I need help. The first thing is that we retain all the data in our existing disease surveillance system called MEDS, and it has enormous data security around that. we would contract with a vendor to provide us a new IT interface that the contact tracers could use. The data would interface with our med system. The data would continue to be retained in our med system and be MDH data with all the privacy constraints around it. And we are looking at systems that other states have used, and those privacy needs have been addressed already, but we would ensure that whatever data was in the system was retained with the privacy that it needs. The governor's executive order directs us to share the addresses of positive cases with public safety, and we have established a protocol around that sharing where the data is shared with dispatchers on a daily basis, both a list of new addresses and a list of addresses that are no longer what we would consider COVID because they have been released from isolation. And so the protocol requires that the dispatcher both add the new addresses to their database and remove the old addresses from the database, and that be done in an encrypted exchange of information. So any new addresses that are provided during, actually any new addresses at this point forward that are provided are shared under the protocol that we've established with the Department of Public Safety based on
follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Munson.
This is for you, Madam Chair. I'm just on the bill. I know we haven't nailed down the cost and where the money is going to come from outside of just the general fund, but is there anything in your bill that restricts the money to only being used in Minnesota? As you know, with contract tracing, and if someone is test positive but just came from a flight from another state, will funds from this bill be used to employ work done in other states for contract tracing?
Well, thank you for that question, Representative Munson. That's a really interesting question. I mean, of course, I'm thinking about Minnesota, but if somebody lives on the border, I guess what would you say about that, Representative Munson? If somebody lives on the border and they report to the Department of Health that they've had contacts across the border, what would you say? Should we not follow up with those people? Or, I mean, I can ask Deputy Commissioner Kelly what would be the practice there, but I don't know. That's just a really good question. What would be your thinking about using that money across the border?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I was going to also ask if there was an effort from the CDC or some national contract tracing that's going on that we would be coordinating with, so we're not duplicating efforts. But I guess that was just my concern, is that money could be used. There isn't anything in the bill that I can see that restricts it from only being used in Minnesota. So that was, I guess, my question. I would be interested to know if there's a federal effort of contract tracing that we would be coordinating with.
Commissioner Kelly?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I am not aware of a federal effort to coordinate contact tracing. I do know that we have collaborated with other states for those outbreaks that are happening right on the border. I've lost a sense of time. I think it was maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago where there were cases at a power plant, I think a wind power plant in either the Fargo, Moorhead, or Grand Forks area. And there were employees at the plant. The plant was in North Dakota, I believe, and employees at the plant lived in Minnesota. And so we did work collaboratively with the local health department there to provide contact tracing and outreach. Oftentimes, and this has happened a very few number of times, where somebody will be tested in Minnesota, but they don't reside in Minnesota because they were here, they were sick, they went to the hospital, they got tested. And so we do outreach for those individuals because they are a positive case reported here to Minnesota, and we don't know at the time that we begin our outreach that they are not a Minnesota resident, but that's very few.
Right. So, yeah, thank you. So maybe, you know, there's something to think about. One of the good reasons we vet bills in committee, and then we get lots of people's ideas. So maybe we need to think about a little language or a little bit more structure around that, because if, for example, resources were needed to isolate someone, but they live in South Dakota, one would expect South Dakota to do that isolation work, not Minnesota, even if we have some collaboration and we can't be so strict. Obviously, the virus doesn't know there's a border, so we just have to work with that. So just so members know, we have Grunhagen, Hamilton, Knorr, Baker, and Franson. So, and then we do have a couple of amendments on this bill as well. So Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I've got a couple quick questions, and you kind of touched on it already in one of your comments. You can answer this quickly. Is there a sunset clause on this, or does it just go on unending? And you used the word temporary at one point. Is it spelled out in the bill?
So Representative Grunhagen, yeah, House Research drafted the bill to be temporary. It doesn't, they asked me this, and I said, absolutely, this is temporary. And there is an ending date for the, the ending date for the money. If you look on line 3.10, actually, this is the bill that says this section expires February 1st, 2021. So obviously, we're in this situation where none of us knows how long this kind of activity is going to be needed. I suspect it may be needed longer than the actual peacetime emergency. I mean, hopefully we can relax some of these rules, but we're still going to be needing to follow up on cases that occur, because the cases are not going to suddenly disappear with the peacetime emergency. And so my thought was, in the way the bill is drafted, is to have this go until we're back in session and we can reconsider it. But also, Ms. Clarkvist is on the call, and if she might want to comment on this as well. Ms. Clarkvist?
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I think Representative Liebling accurately described it. The section expires February 1st, 2021.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, just one more. I'm trying to get my to understand this completely as far as this testing. So I have a friend who's a microbiologist. He's retired from a pharmaceutical company. He thinks we should use a targeted approach, especially with those most vulnerable, like nursing homes and compromised immune systems, for testing. So under this bill, would we go to everybody to test? Like, I could be tested one day and then be exposed the next. And then also there's a pretty high failure rate on some of these tests. Or are you just going to test people who request to be tested and then go from there? I hope you understand where I'm coming from, and either, you know, one of the testifiers can respond or whatever. In other words, if a family's basically healthy, are they going to be requested to come in to be tested, or are you going to wait till somebody has a symptom or desires to be tested?
So, Representative Grunhagen, I just want to frame this up that we're not primarily here to talk about testing today, and I think we could have, and we have had, another complete committee on that issue. So maybe we can get a brief answer, and then we could take that part of it offline, because this is really the next phase. This is, what do you do with once you've identified somebody, you've tested them, and you've identified them as having the virus, what happens next? So I know that Ms. Kelly also started off by talking about expanding testing, but that's already a piece that's in process. But if she can answer quickly, or if Mr. Huff can answer quickly, that'd be fine.
Are they going to be required to be tested? I guess that's, or is it?
Right.
Madam Chair and Representative, we're encouraging every individual who is symptomatic to be tested. And in some settings, if there is somebody who tests positive, we are encouraging more widespread testing, because if there's one person in a nursing home who's positive, there's likely more. But we are not requiring anyone to go in and get tested.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen?
Okay. Yeah,
Thank you. Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was brought up about Nobles County and specifically to the city of Worthington. The number of positives coming out of that, some have reported that it's comparable to the city of New York. And going back to your question, what next with the information that we have, my question is to Deputy Commissioner Kelly. Out of the number positive in the city of Worthington, how many of those were asymptomatic? What out of them, how many were hospitalized and how many in the ICU?
Commissioner Kelly, do you have that information with you?
Madam Chair and Representative, I do not have that information with me. We are tracking cases at the county level and not at the city level. And I don't have the information in front of me in terms of within Nobles County, how many have been hospitalized and how many are in the ICU. If you'd like, I can get that information to you. I don't know if we know how many were asymptomatic when they were tested.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, okay, Madam Chair. Thank you. If you could get us that information, I think it'd be helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My quick question is, I think Deputy Commissioner Kelly can answer this question. While we're providing the wraparound services to the local public health, are we also providing help with transportation for patients who have contracted COVID-19? Is there a plan to have a separate transportation, or are they going to be using ambulances, which may increase the cost of services if they use that service?
Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I believe that at the local level, they're providing the wraparound services include transportation if they need to go from their home to the doctor or from their home to the hospital. And then they're bringing other services to them. If they need medications, they pick them up and bring them to them. If they need groceries, they pick those up and bring them to them.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Knorr, I did realize after I got the draft that transportation was something that could be itemized in here as well. But the language is written purposely to be inclusive. So it certainly would not exclude transportation. It's meant to allow a lot of flexibility for local needs. And that's another one that you've identified. It's very important. Thank you for that. Did you have a follow-up?
No, thanks.
All right, thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The part I wanted to identify is a concern that I have for the bill that kind of prohibits that employer from preventing staff that are furloughed. This is a pretty major change in kind of the philosophy of what employers have a right to do or not to do. And I understand, where this is at. I think you kind of even explained early on, this is kind of squishy language yet for you yet, and you're not even sure how the Senate would react to this. I'm concerned that this might need some more committee time. Have you thought about bringing this to the Jobs Committee, Madam Chair? I think as an employer myself, I would not want to have more perceived language that looks like we're taking away some employer, I don't want to call it control, but just sort of trying to count on their employees to come back and that they've been hanging on and waiting for. So just little comments on that. And have you talked to maybe Chair Mahoney about this? Thank you.
So Representative Baker, thanks for that question. I have not talked to Chair Mahoney. This has come together very, very quickly. I'm not wedded to this language, but I do want to deal with this problem if it's really a problem that I've heard about, that there are employees who could be helpful and are just being prohibited from doing that, not with the intention of taking them away from their current employer, but just allowing them to help us, to be soldiers in this war when we need them, because we really do need people. It's kind of all hands on deck here. And you can see that with the number of people that there are going to need to do this work or could potentially need, and how important and central this is to our whole economy and getting back on track. So I'm not wedded to this. It does need to have more public scrutiny. It does need to, I do need to get input from the hospital association, et cetera. So, you know, just to give you comfort, I'm not trying to jam anybody with this. I just want to make sure that we are not, there isn't an artificial barrier stopping us from getting the assistance of people whose help we very much need to deal with this crisis. So I hear the concern, and I think it was Representative Haley's concern also. So, you know, thanks for raising that, and would be glad to hear from people on how that might affect things. Anything else, Representative Baker?
No, that's fine.
All right, thank you. Representative Franson. Representative Franson, we're not hearing you. I don't know if you're muted. I saw a representative. There you are.
Are you good? Am I good now?
Now I can hear you. Okay. Yes, okay. Please.
So going back to Representative Haley's and Representative Grunhagen and Representative, but regarding those furloughed healthcare workers, right? So are they, so they will need to go back to their regular employer within 1 week, or is it 1 week and then they come back? Can you tell us? I'm getting some people that are kind of confused there.
So thanks for your question, Representative Franson. And the intention, and again, you know, this is all came together very quickly. It might not be in its best and final language, but the intention was just that the employer would just give a week's notice for somebody that they need them back, and then they would return to their previous employment. That's really the intention.
That's the intent. What if they say, nah, you know what, I kind of like the money that I'm making with MDH. I don't really want to go back right now. I mean, is that a possibility too?
Well, Representative Franson, my husband likes to say that slavery is outlawed in the United States. So really, employers can't force people to work. So I suppose that can happen. I suppose that's a risk. But again, these are temporary jobs. This is not a permanent ongoing enterprise. And our expectation is that it's going to come online very quickly, and also go away very quickly, ramp up and ramp down. And I don't know what the intention is in terms of what people would be earning, but I have a feeling that a nurse, for example, is not going to be making full nurse money doing this. That would just be my expectation.
It was just a question, Representative Liebling.
No, and I appreciate it. I'm not, please, I'm trying to answer it in good faith here, and I took it
well,
in good faith.
I know, I think the question, I just think the comment regarding slavery was a little uncalled for.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just, my husband says that to me all the time, you know, when we talk about the fact that, you know, people can't be compelled to do work. So, you know, at the bottom line of that is, if a person decides they no longer want to work for an employer for whatever reason, the employer can't do anything about that. That's just the way it is. But our intention here is not to take employees away from employers and get them hooked on other jobs. We really just want to use the services of people who would otherwise be idle. And frankly, I've been hearing from people, and I bet other members have too, who really want to help. They don't want to be idle. They want to be doing what they can to fight the virus and get us back on track. And whether that's through volunteer efforts or moving over to a job where they feel like they can be useful, even if temporarily, I mean, I think it would be great if we could figure out a way to use that talent. Representative Franson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And then back to the money for the contact tracing. I'm very concerned with the lack of testing taking place in like areas of myself, lack of testing taking place in the nursing homes all across the state. Is it possible that we can, instead of right now, the contact tracing, put that money toward into beefing up our actual testing to make sure that our most vulnerable in the nursing homes are safe, right? Because that's just like right now, the nursing homes and meatpacking place, those are our hot spots. And quite frankly, I'm very concerned, especially since the grandmas and grandpas of our nursing homes across the state do not have our advocates, their relatives or friends being able to go in and actually check on their safety. We are putting a lot of trust into our nursing homes coming off the back of some horrible situations that we had to address last session.
Yeah, so Representative Franson, I think you bring up a very good question, but and I'm not going to address the going back to the problems that we discovered in all of that right now, but just to say in terms of testing and contact tracing, it's got to be both and. So we've got the first part of it in process. The testing is ramping up, and we realize there isn't enough. I mean, if you listen to the what's coming out of the federal government, sometimes they're saying, oh, everyone who wants a test can get one. Clearly, that's not true. We're trying to do our best on the state level as we can to ramp up, and there's been money put toward that, and there's something in process. And Ms. Kelly, I think, or maybe it was Commissioner Malcolm, just recently told me that we're going to hit that 20,000 a day. They are expecting to hit that. So this is ramping up very, very quickly. And money's been allocated to that. And I'm not saying we'll never need more. You know, we may very well. But what we need now is the second piece, because it doesn't, as I said at the beginning, it doesn't do you a lot of good to identify somebody as having the virus if you then don't then follow up. So, for example, a nursing home employee who's identified as having the virus is going to have to be isolated, isn't going to be able to come to work. And if that person doesn't have the ability to get groceries or their medications or whatever, they're not going to be able to stay in quarantine and avoid giving it to someone else. So we need to make sure all these pieces are in place and are seamless with follow-up, that there's much more testing. We all know we need much more testing, but we also need to, we're trying to line up the second phase here before the first phase is fully implemented, because we want to make sure that they both happen. Ms. Kelly, do you want to add anything to that or correct me if I said anything that's not right?
No, we have been doing about, you know, slowly ramping up. I think about a week ago, we were doing 1,000 tests a day. We're up to about 3,000 to 4,000 tests a day being processed by all the labs. But if you have more questions about that, I'm happy to have Assistant Commissioner Huff talk about the work we're doing to, you know, get more testing done at the front end to use the capacity that we've built for the back end.
Representative Franson? Okay, thank you so much. All right, I'm not seeing other questions right now on this. So we do have, Representative Schultz has a couple of amendments, and these were posted kind of recently. Mr. McQuillan is suggesting to me that maybe what we should do is, if we're going to come back at 6, that we might lay over the bill and then come back to take up the amendments, just to give members more time to look at that. How do members feel about that? Do you want to? I know everybody's probably hoping we're not going to come back at 6, but the amendments that Representative Schultz has are, you know, this is one of those ship leaving the harbor, and we want to put some related barnacles on it. And they're not, so they're not directly related to the testing or tracing. So would members, maybe just if you're on video, just wave at me if you would like to lay it over and take it up at the end of the hearing. Is anybody taking that position right now? I see one. Would you all prefer to take up the other amendments at the end? Okay, I think most people would like to do that now and get it out of the way. So, okay. So let's then go ahead with that. Representative Schultz, and I'm hoping we can put the amendments up on the screen. and Representative Schultz, and they do also pertain to the Department of Health. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So I don't know what the First Amendment number is. Let me see if I can, if Patrick puts it up on the screen. But I'll just talk about them in general. So I believe there's I think it's the A1 amendment. So these amendments, here we go.
Right, the A1.
Yep, there it is. Okay, so this amendment, what it does is there's been a request from the Minnesota Department of Health to delay the assisted living licensure that was passed last session, the rulemaking piece, because of COVID and trying to prop the rules up and implement them, they've requested a delay. So I know there's not a lot of support for that delay, but given the crisis we're in, it seems like it might need to go forward, that delay, on both because of the MDH limited resources that they have to both respond to the crisis and finalize the rulemaking, and on the provider side as they try to address the crisis. So if there is a delay, there's delay language. There's also negotiated language on some technical corrections to the assisted living licensure that we passed last year that's agreed upon by the stakeholders. And then there's also language to implement the consumer protections that similar to those we passed in House File 90. Instead of delaying the consumer protections, going forward with those next August, even though we're not stand, if there is a delay in the licensure itself, we can help protect consumers from terminations of leases and giving them more ability to get more information on termination of their housing component, for instance. And so there's a lot of language here, but it's very similar to what we already passed in House File 90 in terms of the consumer protections. And given the COVID crisis that we're experiencing and that 80% of the deaths related to COVID are in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, I think it's urgent that we implement these consumer protections now rather than delaying those. So these are the amendments. I know I apologize for sending this out late, and I want to thank our House research staff, Elizabeth Clarkvist, for getting this ready in time for this last committee hearing. So it's important that we do this now so we have time to vet this language and discuss it. If we do move forward on the delay of licensure, it's also important that we move this together. If there is a delay in licensure, we want to make sure we're implementing these consumer protections. And given what's already been stated in this committee, this is so important to make sure we're protecting our most vulnerable individuals in the state.
So, Representative Schultz, you have this A1 amendment, and then there's an amendment to the amendment to put the consumer protections in it. Is that right? Or does this have that in it?
Looking through it right now. I think Ms. Clarkvist, if she's online, maybe since she just drafted this, I think this is, the A1 is the consumer protections. I know there was an earlier amendment on the delay. I'm wondering if that's a separate amendment.
Ms. Clarkvist, if you could you just walk us through the amendment? That would be helpful, I think, especially since members haven't had a lot of time to see what this is.
I think the A1 is everything. It's what I'm hearing from Chris McCall. Thanks, Chris.
Ms. Clarkvist.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Schultz is correct. The A1 amendment contains what's called the consensus language. It contains the delay language, delaying assisted living licensure for a year. And then the last section of the amendment is the consumer protections language. So everything is in this document.
Okay, so Representative Schultz, is moving the A1 amendment to the to House File 4579 as amended. So this is amending the DE that we adopted. I think it would be probably, let's see, I have a couple of members on the list at this point, and I'm not sure if it was to this, but I will call on you. I have Grunhagen and Keel, but first I'm going to go to Ms. Kelly or Mr. Huff for comment on this delay, because this was a request that came from the Department of Health. And I think that they need to maybe explain it. This was, if you all remember, this was a major piece of legislation from last session. It took a huge amount of work from advocates, from providers, and a major step forward for Minnesota. And I think everyone's disappointed and doesn't really want to delay the implementation. But we understand from the department that this is something that they really need. So, Ms. Kelly, can you fill us in a little bit from the department's perspective?
Sure, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Lisa Timian, our legislative assistant, to join me on this. Pretty much as Representative Schultz described, we are using all of our staff and resources to respond to the pandemic. And nursing facilities are doing the same, which is why we're recommending the delay. But I will turn it over to Lisa Timian to provide more context.
Ms. Timian, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Lisa Timian, I'm Legislative Director for the Department of Health. As we've discussed with folks, it was a really hard realization within the last few months when we realized that we weren't going to be able to meet the very aggressive implementation of the assisted living licensure as we had originally intended. And we worked really hard on over the past few sessions to get to that. For all the reasons outlined above, I will note this work will continue just on a different pace than what we would have wanted before. So we're really, you know, looking to this 1 year delay. And then additionally, the consumers, advocates and the provider stakeholder groups have been meeting as well to provide input on some technical fixes that need to happen. So we've been working with them on that. But yeah, this was a really difficult decision, and we do appreciate the legislature's understanding that it's just very difficult to do all of these things at the same time.
And so, Ms. Timian, are we able to, you know, what about the consumer protection aspect of this? I mean, what I've heard some concerns about this is people are worried that without this licensing going forward, that we're leaving consumers in these assisted livings without protection that they especially need now.
So actually, you know, the consumer protections that are at the heart of this law really do remain in effect. And we've already noticed that this year, in terms of the work that's been happening as we've seen outbreaks of facilities, it's been beneficial that we've had these protections in place and to provide some additional ability to assist the folks living in these facilities. For the protections in place, there is this question of how do we fit in for this additional gap year for folks in the housing with services. We haven't had a lot of time, I think, to think about what that actually looks like. It's tricky because that doesn't fall under Department of Health jurisdiction until there's a assisted living licensure piece. And that's the part that's tricky in trying to figure out how to best address service terminations and other issues that happen when it's under the housing with services scheme, which is the reason we did all this work to get to this assisted living licensure in the first place. So a long way to answer that.
All right. So let me go to Representative Grunhagen and then Keel. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, I had my hand up to go to 6 o'clock and do this later. So I'll pass.
All right. Thank you. Representative Keel. And you must
There we go. I kind of forget about that, you know, depending on who's controlling what. So, I have some concerns. First of all, I want to know if there was consensus in the entire, and I should point out first, thank you, Representative Schultz, for calling me. And we have briefly talked about this before it came out. And as you said, it came out as we were already starting our committee hearing. But what I would like to know is It was said that there's a consensus in the language. So what do the providers have to say about this this additional changes in the bill?
Representative Schultz.
Well, there's agreement on certain provisions. We're calling those, they were in an earlier amendment called the A8 and revisions. On the technical piece, there's agreement. On the consumer protections, they just have concerns about ability to implement them, I believe is what their objection is, without the licensure. But we were able to draft language with House research staff that I think is workable to implement some of the consumer protections on the same timeline as in the legislation we passed last session. So this language is almost identical in terms of the types of protections that we vetted and we passed last session with consensus from the advocates and from the providers.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, can I
ask please, more questions?
Okay, thank you. So, as well as the department having challenges with trying to handle this COVID-19, I know that my local facilities are having a real challenge trying to take care of members, are their residents, and what's happening. We had our first or second incident in a nursing home, and it was staff, and all because of, I heard somebody talking earlier about Grand Forks, North Dakota. A lot of those places had spouses that worked in nursing homes, and my information from one of the nursing homes is they had suspected concern long before, well over 14 days ago, and so what they did, the staff was masked when they were there, and then when they took them out, it was or they didn't work for over 20 days. So while I think they're very nervous about any residents getting sick, they have been handling that and working hard at trying to do this. So now we're requiring them to do more, providers to do more when they're already trying to even find, we've done adaptations for even in hiring people. I have some concerns about being able to actually even go through this bill. I'm trying to do that as we're talking here. Makes it kind of challenging, but I really think we should have heard from the providers. We heard from Lisa Timnyan, so we've heard from MDH, but there were a lot of things discussed in negotiations over the last, I'd say 3 years, at least, when this first came to light. And certainly we don't want anyone mistreated or not, handled, taken care of. I'm just wondering, have we really discussed how this current law will enact with landlord tenants and home care laws? I see some things in here that were questionable back then. Are we putting them back in just because the one side of the group wants them? And I'm just looking at this thinking I might have needed more time to really read through this because I think we should just work with the changes in dates and the things that needed to be updated, and then discuss the other things that we didn't have agreement with before.
Right. So, Representative Keel, I think probably be fair to say nobody really wants to do this. But these are things that are in place to happen if we don't do something to have them not happen. So I wanted to call Ms. Clarkquist to see if, she can shed any further light on this. Ms. Clarkquist?
Madam Chair, I haven't been a direct part of any negotiations between providers and consumer groups and the department, so I don't have any direct knowledge of what has been agreed to and what has been not agreed to, except that the Mark Schultz from the Health Department has reported that the delay language and the consensus language have both been agreed to.
Okay. So Representative Schultz, did you want to respond?
Yes. So remember that we're really concerned about it's the assisted living facilities that are not regulated or licensed in Minnesota. So this language is adopted to housing with services. So we have a lot of protections for nursing homes. What we want to do is protect residents in assisted living facilities or housing with services facilities. So, and also this is not going to be implemented until next August, these consumer protections. So we have time next session to work on the language if we need to fix anything technical. We also, the facilities also have time to understand these consumer protections. Although I think since we went through it last year, I think they all have a good understanding of those protections. So, you know, hopefully this COVID crisis, we will get over this relatively soon and that won't be an issue. We also think that many of these protections already interact with current law, so it wouldn't be that much work. The question you had about the appeals are not in the language. It's just gives better discharge planning and protections to residents, which they don't currently have, and make sure that they have adequate housing if they do get discharged.
Okay, so
Madam Chair, I realize. Thank you very much. I realize we need to move on, but I have a real. I'm a no on this right now. Representative Schultz, I have a real problem with. I thought about what you said when we talked earlier, and I really have a problem with. I don't want to kick anybody out in the street ever, but I also know that I can get a call. And what I assumed from a loved one today as they're functioning in an assisted living tomorrow is an immediate change. Not, and I can't always find a place. So it really makes it difficult for an assisted living. And I would tell you from all my conversations about assisted living, and I know I'm a broken record on this, people do not move into assisted living to have the same care that they do for nursing homes. They don't want that. In fact, ironically, so while we're at home, I have been moving my parents into a 55 plus apartment, and I can tell you for sure my father's not real thrilled about even moving off the farm, but it was for their safety and their care. However, they want to live independently, and I believe that we are doing some things to their independence that is not there. I really have some concerns. I certainly would support the amendment at the beginning because I know we need those dates changed for both MDH and the facilities themselves. And I just, this part that is not agreed to, that we still have some things to work out. Many people are protected. We can work on those things. And I would even argue that most of our assisted livings have already worked on all of these issues and are providing the best they can. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me some latitude.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Keel. And I realize this is really, we are rushing things, and I really do apologize for that. I know that puts members in a bit of a bind, but that's kind of the, unfortunately, the situation that we are in. I have Representative Haley. We do have to stop at 2:15. So I'm going to take Representative Haley, and then we're going to move to a brief final comment if Representative Schultz has one, and then we're going to vote on the amendments. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. I just really want to echo what Representative Keel said. I feel like this is quite disjointed and almost a little backwards. As you said previously, there was so much work done on this legislation last session. And I feel like we're kind of tearing it in two parts and separating the rulemaking from the consumer protection pieces just doesn't fit with me. And I'm concerned that there's too many unintended consequences here. I have not had a chance to talk to the facilities in my area that I represent about their concerns. And so there, I am definitely a no, and I would just encourage us to take a pause on this. I know end of session is coming, but we don't want to make bad decisions because we're rushed, and we know we're going to, or I guess I believe we're going to have additional session meetings over the summer to respond to COVID. So if this continues to be a concern, we'd have time to work with the stakeholders and get it right rather than rushing something today.
Representative Schultz, any final brief word?
Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling and members. And I understand the concerns we have about timing. I wish we did have more time, but this is really important. And, you know, when we first initially started talking about licensing assisted living facilities, the consumer protections were going to be implemented earlier before licensure. They wanted to make sure the consumer protections got implemented as quickly as possible, even if we weren't ready on the licensure. So I don't have a concern that we would implement consumer protections with housing with services before the licensure takes effect. And we can talk to our community organizations that are housing with services and come back next year. But I think we need this language as a starting position for next year to make sure consumers are protected as much as possible because of the long delay in the licensure, which would not be implemented until 2022. We can't wait that long to have consumer protections in place. So I just think it's vital that we start now and we don't delay.
Okay, so members, normally we would just do a voice vote on an amendment, but you know, I realize that some of you may want a recorded vote. Is anybody asking for a roll call, or should we just do a voice vote on the amendment? Okay, I see there's a request for roll call. Is that what that is, Representative Franson? Okay, so there will be a roll call on the amendment. So Ms. Niedernhofer, the chair votes aye.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Baker, no.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Franson.
No.
Grunhagen.
No.
Haley.
No.
Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
No.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
No.
Kunish Pudin.
Aye.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson.
Aye.
Noor.
Aye.
Olson excused. Schultz.
Aye.
There being 12 ayes and 7 nays, the amendment is adopted. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4579, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll. I'm sorry, Representative Franson, I'm sorry, were you seeking to be recognized? Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say, regarding House File 4579, Madam Chair, in County of Ventura there just did a press conference on contact tracing, and it does have me concerned because I know sometimes the states piggyback off of each other and ideas are shared from state to state. Madam Chair, what is happening is it's being told that the Ventura County of California is talking about removing positive people or those that test positive for COVID or COVID-19 from homes with less than one bathroom per person as part of their contract tracing and surveillance for their phased reopening. So, for example, if somebody is tested positive, they contact trace, they find out, oh, this individual only is in a home, let's say with 3-4 other people, there's one restroom in that home, they remove people in order to stop the spread, so to speak, if you're following me. And I think that has some concerns that we need to talk about. And I think today I'm going to have to vote no, because I just, there's too many unknowns on what I'm finding out, what's happening in California. There's what happens to, what if somebody chooses not to share with who they have been around? Maybe they don't want big government knowing who they've spoken to or been around with. What are those repercussions and stuff? So, Madam Chair, while I believe that your bill is in good intentions, there's still some unknowns out there that I just don't feel comfortable with supporting if there's going to be some forceful actions that take place.
Okay, well, thank you, Representative Francis. So this bill is not changing any of the law around any of this. It's just really appropriating money for the purpose. But you did remind me that I forgot that I have not made the motion. I'm going to make an oral amendment to put the money into the bill. So members, I would move to what I'd like to do is online 3.14, in the blank space, I would insert 25 million. And on line 3.19, I would insert 200 million. And that's my oral amendment. Does everybody have that? We're going to need to vote on that to get that into the bill. And again, I just want to remind everyone, these are placeholder numbers. They will definitely be changing as we get more information, but just we don't want to move a blank bill out of committee. So any discussion to that amendment? All right, I think we can just take a voice vote on that. So all those in favor of that oral amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Okay, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted, and we will now move to a vote on the bill, which is, once again, I would move that House File 4579, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll on the bill, and the chair votes aye.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
So I got a text message that's
Akam.
Akam, aye.
Baker.
Baker, no.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Branson. Branson.
Muting me.
Branson?
No.
Grunhagen.
No.
Haley.
No.
Halverson.
Yes.
Hamilton.
No.
Jordan.
Yes.
Heal.
No.
Kunish Podin. Kunish Podin. Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson.
A no.
Nor.
Aye.
Olson excused. Schultz.
Aye.
Ten ayes and eight nays.
Did everyone vote who wanted to vote? I don't know if sometimes on these calls we miss people. Anyone whose vote was not counted? Okay, there being ten ayes and eight nays, The motion prevails and the bill is passed to Ways and Means. So members, we are going to reconvene at 6 o'clock. We have a couple of other bills to take up. Those are Representative Moran's bills, and hopefully they won't take us too long, but we will reconvene at 6 p.m. So we stand in recess. Thank you very much. All right, I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division back to order from recess. Welcome back, everyone. Seems like we just left. I know. But thank you all for coming back this evening so we can finish up a couple of important bills. So I don't think we need to officially count a quorum again, although I think that we do have, I think I can tell that a lot of the members are here. And so I think we can probably get right to it. And Representative Moran, are you here? I think I saw you. There you are.
Representative Liebling, I am here.
Excellent. So we're going to go first to House File 3563, Representative Moran. And Representative Moran, would you like to move your bill?
Oh, okay. We're doing 3563 first. And I'm sorry, but my video won't open up so I can see, so you can see me.
Oh, okay. So, well,
we're going to work it. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So, Madam Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Well, first, Representative Moran is going to first move the bill to be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Yes.
And then Representative Moran has an A1 amendment to put the bill in the form in which she would like to discuss it. And so, Representative Moran, should we adopt that first?
Yes, Madam Chair. And I have two amendments.
Okay. So let's just, and they're both, as I understand it, they're both technical amendments. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the A1, Representative Moran is moving the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? This is just to put it in the order in which she wants to discuss the bill. So if everyone would just unmute, I think we can do this on a voice vote. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. And then there's an A3 amendment. Is that the one you wanted to move, Representative Moran?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Moran now moves the A3 amendment, again, to get the bill in the form in which she'd like to discuss it. Any discussion to that motion? All right. All those in favor of the A3, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, Representative Moran, we have the amended bill before us. Please go ahead and present the bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. For the purposes of the A1 amendment, what it does, it removes the requirement for DHS to update the table consistent with the quadrennial review. And then the A3 amendment, fixed language, adding or, and moving the phrase highlighted before the bullet list to reflect the intent, which is to ensure the court is clear that it may be deviant from the table when the only change in circumstances is an increase to the custodian parent's income. And one of the three conditions below applies. So the way it's currently written, it is missing the word or, which means all three would need to apply.
Okay.
That was not the intent.
All right. Okay. All right. Very good. Why don't you go back to the beginning and just give us a brief overview of what the bill is about. And then we do have some testifiers. So.
Okay. So the bill supports recommendation that was put forth by the Child Support Task Force, which was created in 2016. And included a diverse group of stakeholders to review and recommend changes to our current child support guideline table. The table has not been updated since January 1st of 2007. The task force met over the course of 2.5 years and issued a final report in October of 2019. During this process, the task force engaged many experts, communities, and stakeholders regarding the proposed changes. The members of the task force updated the current guideline by making adjustment to the USDA cost estimate for child support expenses and in addition to other changes. Studies show that ordering a parent to pay a child support order that is set too high causes conflict between the parents, giving the receiving parents unreasonable expectation and frustrating the paying parents that they cannot provide a support required in addition to their own living expenses. So in 2011, a study out of Orange County, California found that in order to maximize compliance and consistency of payments, order must be set within a parent's ability to pay. And parents with low conflict and high family participation are most likely to make their payments. If that happens, it is definitely a win-win for the children. So the proposed changes to the guideline table reflected in House File 3563 are more fair and equitable in order to do a few things. It promotes family connections between both parent and children. It decreases conflict and stress between parents that is detrimental to them and their children. It increases consistency and reliability of child support payments to help stabilize children's households. And it increases self-sufficiency for families. So this legislation is supported by the Minnesota Family Support and the Recovery Council, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators in Ramsey County. So it has, you know, really good support. It is also a bipartisan bill. I have been working really closely with Representative Peggy Scott. And so in saying that, I would like to turn this over to my next testifier, Amy Anderson.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Moran. So, okay, well, I had on the list to testify, I had former Representative Diane Anderson, but certainly Amy Anderson, if you wanted to had some explanation to add to the bill, that would be fine. Are you here?
I am here, Chair. This is Amy Anderson from Ramsey County. Thank you. I just want to clear up a little confusion that I had. You had identified this as Bill House File 1050. This is actually House File 3563.
No, we know we're on 3563.
Okay, great. I'm testifying in place of Melissa Rosso this evening because she had an obligation that she couldn't get out of. Melissa was a member of the Child Support Guideline Task Force that was created by the legislature in 2016. The legislature outlined what members should be on the task force, and it included 4 members from the legislature, including Representative Peggy Scott and Representative Lori Pryor. It included 4 parents, 2 obligated parents, and 2 parents who were receiving support. It included legal aid. It included the Minnesota Bar Association with the Family Law Section. It included a representative of the courts, a representative of the Tribal Child Support Program, a representative from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and someone from the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council. And also someone from the Department of Human Services. That entire group met over 29 times from September 2016 to June 2019. They issued their report to the legislature in October of 2019. That report did include a minority report. The task force had really long and thorough meetings discussing all of these issues, all these concerns and issues that were raised. And they consulted with economists, received public feedback at nearly all the meetings. some meetings set aside solely for public feedback. And they came up with this recommendation. And this was a task the legislature gave them to complete. And they have done so. And then Ramsey County brought the bill forth since it wasn't being brought forth by DHS. So we wanted to get it going. And the file that's in front of you are the recommendations, the most of them which were approved by the task force. And that's all I have.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And members, we can, I don't see any questions, but we could probably hold those to the end and there'll be an opportunity to ask questions of any of the testifiers. Former Representative Diane Anderson, did you also want to add? Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Diane Anderson. I'm a former state representative, and I worked on this a couple of sections. I've worked on sections 5 and 6 of this bill specifically, and there was a group of people who worked on this those sections with me, and we received technical assistance from DHS, and we also been working with legal aid on some of the language. I believe these sections of bill are non-controversial, and I think, and from what I've seen of the fiscal note, there are no fiscal impacts on from sections 5 and 6. So basically what these two sections do is modifies our current statute 518A.40 regarding just the child care portion of child support payments. There's three parts to the child support amount. There's a basic child support amount, a child care support, and medical support. So the child care support must be based on the actual child care expenses, and the current law does not adequately address some issues regarding the when these child care expenses change, and so that's the focus of this these two sections here. In many cases, the obligor is not notified when the child care expense changes or ends, and so this bill is requiring the obligee to notify the obligor when the child care expense ends, and also gives the obligor an annual document with the child care expenses from the previous year. And so one of the other things we're trying to do with in these two sections was to just have a low cost way for people to get their child support modified when there has been a change in the child care expenses. And so those are the main issues of why we are putting out sections 5 and 6. And I can stand for any questions if you want any more details.
Great, thank you very much. And Ms. Anderson, I know you're a former representative. I served with you, but are you representing anybody today, or are you just here as a private citizen?
As a private citizen today.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, we have a couple of other testifiers who wanted to speak to us about the bill. Jacob Quaid. Is Jacob Quaid
yep.
here?
Can you see me now? Yep.
Okay, I can hear you. Yes, okay, welcome.
You.
Welcome to the committee. And please just tell us your name and if you represent anyone, and then just 1 or 2 minutes, please.
Okay. My name is Jacob Quaid, and I'm here representing just as a private citizen. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee. Thank you and welcome and allowed for me to speak this evening at this evening's hearing. There's a couple of points I want to bring up as just recommending or asking that every legislator on this committee, curious if you all have ever read the Child Support Performance State Report. This is a required report to the feds about collection of the rates of this program. That's a wealth of information. Every legislator who has not read this should read this and be informed before they vote on this bill. It's important not to overlook the table. It is based on gross income of both parents, and the state is saying how much money we should spend on kids monthly in one house. If these numbers come from the USDA, the USDA says 29% is for housing, which parents are no longer together. Each parent has to find their own housing, and each parent has to have space for their child. Why isn't 29% taken off the top for each number on here? If it's claimed to be housing adjustment, then why is it not put on there? This bill does not allow for full disclosure to the public, which is no way for the average person to even know what the final child support obligation will be in this bill alone. And there's no way to know even if it's enough to qualify for modification. Does everybody know what it costs to hire an attorney for a modification? If you can't afford child support, you can't afford an attorney to reduce the child support. The table is way too high. Why don't people who create this chart not seek to assure a reasonable table? the table is even lower. This says two parents are even making $15 our gross income. They spend $818 a month for one child for basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, and transportation. Child support is not intended for sports, camps, and other expenses. That's all extra. $818 does not include child care and medical, which can be $5 to $1,000 monthly. At this rate, nobody can afford to have kids, especially two households. Why is child support based on gross income and not net? Nobody pays their bills off their budget on gross income, so it needs to be changed to net income. There's also many problems with child support, and majority of all the same programs have remained unaddressed for over 30 years. Parents go to jail and get their driver's license taken away, and they can't afford to basically pay the high child support. So the county agencies take away their license for 14 years, and now they drop little and raise and earn approximately $31,000 a year to $48,000 a year with one child, and it's supposed to be a victory. This bill window was addressing to make child support agency have compassion. No dad have ever talked to in the state would say child support is compassion. In fact, there's enforcement measures based upon input income are more dramatic than to the IRS. All child support cases in the 4D system with the percent of them falling into income ranges will see an increase. All those between $5,200 and $62,000 annual joint income. I'll just ask for that members remember that when they're voting as well. Brought up earlier about Orange County, California, no more than 18% in California. Well, in California, that support includes medical and child care. In Minnesota, that's added on top of the 18%. We have to provide medical and child care. So,
okay, Mr. Craig, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have Mike Sieber. Mr. Sieber, are you here?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Please introduce yourself and represent anyone. Oh. Go ahead.
I'm Mike Sieber. Hi, everybody. And thank you. I attended almost all the task force meetings. I was there for, it seemed like a lot more than 29 of them. It appears like this bill is in reference to a transmittal to the states from the federal government dated January 5th, and there's another one dated January 9th, basically telling them that the low income orders are too high, among other things. So it's great that child support is being reduced in this bill. That's a wonderful thing. However, it's too little and too late. The agency has known since 2006 that these tables were way too high. They changed the tables several times to include income shares. And then again, they made a parenting time adjustment. And at both those junctures in years past, it was also known that the orders were too high. People are going to jail. You are incarcerating people for not being able to pay these too high orders. And this is a victory, it's a tiny step in the right direction, but this is not really a victory for those people who were ordered to pay way more than they had the ability to. And that is actually a federal requirement that they have, the orders are set for people's ability to. I forgot to mention, I'm known as the grumpy child support critic. Yeah, I've been around way too long. I've been doing this since 1992. And it seems highly irregular to me that Ramsey County is bringing this bill. Why isn't the Minnesota Department of Human Services bringing this bill? It's in their jurisdiction. But at any rate, there's far too many problems yet to be addressed to take a lot of victory laps on this and to congratulate ourselves. There is a huge problem with imputation of income, driver's license and professional license suspensions, asset seizures, arrests, financial institute data matches, program irregularities and mistakes, orders still being set way too high. A major problem in this bill and with these tables since the very beginning is that the USDA basis that the tables are based on, even though it was deviated downwards, is not data. It's self-reported figures that I don't believe even qualify as data. Using gross income, as the previous gentleman said, is not appropriate. The reason this was discussed in the task force and the reason they wouldn't go for net income is that the Minnesota Department of Human Services' agency is afraid that people are cheating on their taxes and they wouldn't take the net income from people's tax returns. It's been known long before the 2011 Orange County study that the orders need to be set reasonably. We didn't need that. Amy Anderson, I've known for probably 20 years. I thank her for her work on this. And she mentioned that the committee took public comment, or the task force took public comment, but I don't believe they addressed any meaningful issue coming out of that public comment. I testified many times, others testified. I recorded almost all the meetings, and I don't see any meaningfully addressing any of those comments that were maybe inconvenient.
Okay, Mr. Sieber, I need you to kind of wrap it up if you could.
That's really all I had, so thank you for hearing me. I appreciate that.
All right, and Mr. Sieber, you didn't say whether, I assume you're just a private citizen, right?
Yes, I am, yes.
Okay,
yes.
And I just wanna say, you know, at the legislature, we really benefit from people who are private citizen advocates who come and become experts in an area and give us their expertise. And I just wanna thank you for doing that. I don't think I've met you before, but you know, we appreciate your advocacy. We know that we have plenty of people around advocating because they're paid to do so, and we appreciate those who do it because they care about an issue. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
So with that, are there questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Yes, would it be okay if I could have Amy Anderson respond to maybe some of Dick and Mike Sieber's concerns?
Well, if members have questions about it, I think we could do that. I don't know if, I'm not seeing that any members do have questions.
Fine.
So, you know, if members do want to hear some response, you know, please do ask. But I'm not seeing any. Oh, yes, Representative Baker.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I'm glad this is a super small step forward, but I wanted to maybe ask Representative Moran, because I don't hear much of this. I've been in this committee for a few years now, and this is the first time I've really kind of heard about child support and reforming it to a way that starts making hopefully less conflict with mom and dad. I think that's a big part of why I think this is a good thing. I've always had a problem with and typically as an employer, I've seen this with fathers that whether they get behind or they've had some issues with addiction and they're trying to get back everything right. But I've seen too many people lose their driver's license because they are behind in child support payments. Is this the kind of task force or the same kind of group we have to work through in the future to address this kind of an issue? Because I see that as too problematic for people keeping jobs when they're taking away their driver's license. And can you just address that, I guess, Representative Moran? And if folks like me want to address this in the future, this is a problem that I think we need to continue with. But anyway, just some thoughts on that, I guess, to the author, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Baker, I would definitely agree with you that for way too long, there have been many punitive pieces, and it really doesn't make sense for someone to lose their car and then cannot work in order to pay child support. And I definitely agree with Mike Sieber that, you know, it's been a long time coming. It's a small piece, but it's been just way too long, and it has had really negative impacts on oftentimes fathers, you know, who wants to have a bigger role in the child's life, but because of the poorly tagged with the mother and the father, and the lack of agreement between the two, you know, the father has not always been there for the child. And so this bill would definitely put some parity and some fairness back into however little it is. I'm going to say that, and then I'm going to pass it over to Amy Anderson, who was a part of the Child Support Committee.
Right. Thank you, Representative Moran. Amy Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I was actually not a member of the task force, but I attended all the meetings and did assist in putting this new table together. I am an attorney at Ramsey County that works in the Child Support Enforcement Division. So I'm very familiar with Representative Baker's question about the driver's license suspension. That's one of the things that has been out there for a long time. It typically takes about 6 months of non-payment for someone to actually lose their license. And every county is different. But in Ramsey County, we are willing to work with people all the time on setting up a payment agreement so they don't lose their license. Unfortunately, and I just had a case the other day in court where the person didn't know about the hearing because they don't open their mail. So they need to read notices from us, and then they can contact us and set it up. Our position is never to take someone's driver's license if they can sign a payment agreement. If they think their child support is too high, Ramsey County regularly enters into payment agreements that start at a lower amount and then move up. Gives them a chance to file a motion to reduce their child support if they need to. And so it is something right. that is of concern.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And I just would say, Representative Baker, this is something that has been, it's one of those issues that I've been hearing about for quite a while. And I think this would be more of a public safety committee or maybe judiciary committee kind of issue. But I think you will find a lot of support for your concern about that just as Representative Moran expressed. So. You know,
and thank you, and thank you for that. I just what I'm seeing and hearing is that it takes about every 10 years to make any kind of a small change in this thing. I think we need to be more proactive about the way of the world today and how critical licenses are and things like that. So I do hope that in the future we can be more current on this. So I appreciate the comment on that.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And members, we're really here to deal with the fiscal note. I mean, since we are a fiscal committee, and I wonder, is Mr. Berg is on the call? I think you are. If Mr. Berg, would you be able to just give us a brief explanation of the fiscal note here before we vote on the bill?
Madam Chair, members, yeah, it's a pretty simple fiscal note. It is. It was made based on the 1A amendment that you adopted initially. And I understand the 3A amendment, I would not think would change it. And I understand DHS has confirmed that with Mr. McQuillan. I haven't talked to them directly about it. But this bill costs $123,000 out of the general fund in fiscal 21 with tails of $25,000 a year. And that's entirely for systems modification costs.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Not seeing any further questions from members, I think we're probably ready to move to a vote on the bill. So Representative Moran is going to renew her motion that House File 3563, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. So we'll have to do a roll call on this, and the chair votes aye.
Schumacher. Akam.
Schumacher, aye.
Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Clanson.
Aye.
Grunhagen.
Aye.
Haley. Helverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Aye.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
Aye.
Kunesh Podin.
Aye.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson. Noor.
Aye.
Olson excused. Schultz.
Aye.
And I will go back to the two. I didn't hear a response from Haley and Munson.
All right, so on a vote of 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to Ways and Means. So thank you very much for members and people who came to be testifiers on that bill. We will now move on to the next bill, which is also Representative Moran. And that is House File 1050. And there is also an author's amendment, I understand, on House File 1050. And members, just as context, House File 1050 is a bill that we have heard before. It was part of the omnibus bill in the 2019. It didn't get all the way through, but it is back before us because Representative Moran needs to put this amendment on the bill. So that's why we are kind of rehearing the bill today. So Representative Moran is going to move that House File 1050 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I think she'd like to move the A7 amendment, Representative Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A7 amendment.
All right, to put the bill in the order in which she'd like to have it discussed. So if everyone would just unmute, we can do that on a voice vote, and then we can discuss the bill as amended. So all those in favor of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
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 Please no.
Wow.
All right. Somebody's making a lot of noise in the background, but you can all go back on mute now, and thank you. Okay. So with that, Representative Moran, go ahead and introduce the bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to give some statements around what the amendment does. It does five things. It changes the time of calculating disqualifiers to the date of the conviction of the crime, not the time of the crime was committed. This later date is more clear and easier to determine. The bill adds five additional crimes back into statute after negotiation with Jane Renum and Patty Moses and others. It changes the time for implementation so that DHS can have a year to work with counties on any implementation details. It clears up a new federal policy related to disclosure of records from the FBI. And finally, it clarifies a process to allow foster care youth and others in the home who turn 18 during the pendency of a foster care license but have a disqualifier. So those are the five things. And just as a reminder to everyone, the main purpose of this bill is to bring Minnesota foster care licensing standards more in line with our adoption standards. Under current law, our foster care licensing standards and processes create many more barriers for individuals, including relatives, than our adoption standards. This inconsistency creates problems for placing children in permanent safe homes, and it isn't good for family preservation. This bill also brings Minnesota in line with current federal policies and recommendations related to foster care licensing and background checks. You know, Madam Chair, we really feel that it's time for Minnesota to rethink the way that we license foster care providers. Unlike other providers requiring a DHS license, family foster homes are not a business. They should be a safe haven for children who can't live at home. for communities of color, the statutory barriers in our current foster care licensing statute have a greater impact, and this law will help remedy that disparity. When children can remain with relatives in foster care and stay connected to their families, they have better long-term outcomes, including higher high school graduation rates, decreased rates of mental health disorders, and less overall trauma. COVID-19 has made family visitation for children within the child welfare system difficult. Increasing access for relatives to attain foster care licenses during this time would have made it easier for children to both remain with family, but also see family more often and consistently while they are in the system and out of home and out of their home.
Okay, so Representative Moran, I see that you're muted now. I don't know if you did that on purpose or.
I did not do that.
Oh, okay, so now you were unmuted again, okay.
So finally, the bill is supported by the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administration, the County Attorney Association, several private adoption agencies, Hennepin County, the NWAC of Minnesota, several tribes, the Indian Child Welfare Center, Aspire Minnesota, and many constituents across a breadth of experience and perspective, and provides a well thought out and negotiated balance to ensure that both the safety for children, but also a more reasonable list of barriers that doesn't exclude many wonderful foster parents who have a perfect past. This is a strong bipartisan bill. It is supported by many of our members on Health and Human Service Finance. And so I hope that I can garner the support of us, of our committee once again. And most importantly to me, because the amendment that was put on this bill, the fiscal note in the first year was cut in half. So I'm really excited about that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moran. We have one testifier, Ms. Woolman, and I don't see any questions yet. And so, Ms. Woolman, welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you. It's so nice to see you, Madam Chair. And actually, I just have to say, it's so nice to see all of you during this time here on Zoom legislating. It gives me huge warm feelings about Minnesota. So thank you. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm the director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection and Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. I'm also a professor of law there. And I am here today to just give a brief overview of this bill, and I will keep my comments very brief because we have been here before. It is nice to see you all again. This is an important bill, and this bill will make an actual difference in the lives of children and families in Minnesota. It is good policy, and I would encourage you very strongly to pass it through this committee today. In Minnesota, we currently have a robust system in place in our state to carefully consider and vet individuals who want to be foster care providers. This bill makes that system work better for children and families and for county and state officials who do this work. And it makes it better, I think, for three primary reasons that I want to highlight today. The first reason is that it takes foster care licensing and creates its a separate category for it within the larger DHS licensing statute. And I think that's a very good thing because the larger DHS licensing statute is very onerous and confusing and contains a lot of barriers and disqualifiers that are unrelated directly to child safety. So this is an opportunity for us to create policy that just relates to who we feel will be safe to be a foster care provider in Minnesota. The second reason this bill is really critical in terms of improving our current process is that it includes a new data forward provision. This requirement, which is not in the prior statute, requires the Department of Human Services to give a whole list of information, including all convictions that any individual applying for a foster care license has been convicted of over the years, information about prior employment, information about drug treatment, information about housing stability. There's a long list of requirements that DHS has to give to counties so that the county agents can make a safe, sound, nuanced, and individualized decision about who should get a foster care license for the child that they are working with. What I would like to highlight about the process in this bill is that all convictions that an individual has been, all crimes that someone has been convicted of will be considered both by DHS and by the counties. The list of disqualifying crimes that are contained in the bill currently create unnecessary barriers a lot of the time in Minnesota. And I will just share one point of data with you, which is that we asked DHS in 2018 to look at, for misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors in Minnesota, how many of those minor crimes did people ultimately get a foster care license when there was an initial red flag? Out of 80 applications, 76 were ultimately granted a DHS license. But when I say ultimately, I mean after 4 to 6 months of going through an administrative appeal process that could have been avoided for some of those minor infractions, and which we know we're ultimately going to give that individual a license. So this really is improving on our ability to be responsive more quickly, to meet the individualized needs of children, and to provide relief in a system right now that is lacking in foster care providers.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Wollman. That is very helpful. Are there questions from members? All right. I'm not seeing any. So I think we are probably fully informed and ready to vote, since I'm not seeing any questions. So Representative Moran is going to renew her motion that House File 1050, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So we'll be taking the roll on this bill, and the chair votes aye.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Baker, aye.
Spearman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Franson.
Aye.
Grunhagen.
Aye.
Haley. Helverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Aye.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
Aye.
Kunish Podim.
Aye.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson. Noor.
Aye.
Olson excused. Schultz.
Aye.
Aye. 17 ayes.
All right, so on a vote of 17 to nothing, the motion prevails, and House File 1050 is on its way to Ways and Means. So members, just to conclude here, this is likely our last meeting of this committee for the year. I really appreciate everybody coming back and letting us extend the meeting today. And thank you so much for your participation. Our time to just be sure we thank everybody who's made all of this possible this year. First of all, to all of the members, it's been really wonderful working with all of you this year. Really have appreciated your seriousness and your steadfastness and hard work. I also want to thank our House research staff who just keep the place going. We know that. Ms. Clarkvist, Ms. Punelli, Ms. Sunderman, and Mr. Chun, who are just absolutely fantastic all the time. Mr. Berg, our House fiscal staff, who makes us feel like we know something once in a while. Thank you so much for your help on everything, Mr. Berg, especially. He helps me a lot, even what you guys don't necessarily see. Our partisan researchers, Jeremiah and Joe, our committee legislative assistant, Krista Niedernhofer, our pages who aren't here doing their page work, but hopefully we'll see them again soon, and Patrick McQuillan, who I don't know if you all understand how hard Patrick works, but he definitely keeps this whole thing going. So with great appreciation to all of you for a really great year again, and we'll be seeing each other soon in lots of other contexts. So the meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much.